you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. And what you're about to hear is TechNet number 1568 of the series that began in September 1982. 31 and a fraction, 33, 32 and a fraction years ago. The TechNet is a gathering of guys who are curious, want to know more about radio, how it works, and how to make it work better. They gather here and help each other in that educational process. The goal is to do a mediocre job of teaching wireless technology. From my point of view, they can do a much better job in teaching useful engineering information. The books do a medium good job if you got the right books. But for a ham to tell each other, I built this antenna, I made this change to it, I got this improvement in performance. And the nice thing about this particular hobby is that anything you design with your own hands becomes automatically type accepted by the FCC. Anything you modify, build with your own hands, you're allowed to use it on the air. And so therefore, you use it to talk to other people who have done something similar and find out each other from each other how to make it work better, how to understand it. You'll think that from time to time you're hearing duplication. I mean, the word standing wave ratio, let me drop it, is used over and over again. Almost every second or third TechNet is some kind of a discussion on standing wave ratio, reflections on cables, how high up the standing wave ratio with your particular antenna tuner tolerate, how much insertion loss you're getting because of that, what modifications to the antenna. If I add more ground plane radials, will the standing wave ratio go down? And does that mean the efficiency of the antenna is going up? There's a zillion ways to discuss standing wave ratio. So if you want to simplistically say that, these discussions are repetitive, well, to a degree they are. It's a different slant each time. You've heard me in the past talk about that you can't change the standing wave ratio of a antenna system by changing the length of the transmission line. And Hal and I have had some disagreements on that. And who's right? Well, to a certain degree, we're both right. It depends. If you have a mismatch on both ends, the cable length is very sensitive. If you only have a mismatch on the far end, then it might not be sensitive. And so we're slowly learning about fine details of all these things. A person signs into the TechNet. Let me drop.
Big CPZ is here, so the clicking answers.
Yeah, there's our celebrity. Here tell that not too long ago, a few days ago, he was in a restaurant and they wouldn't let him go. They wanted to get his autograph because of all of the news reports of that that Cessna airplane sitting in his driveway in Oceanside. So we've got a celebrity here, and when you meet him face to face, he'll give you a signed picture. So. And he and I have some interesting discussions from time to time, particularly on the subject of cables. I've discovered this week, in fact, there's more to the story, and there are situations where changing the length of the cable does change the reservoir, particularly if you've got a mismatch on both ends. After we have our first hour or so of general discussions of ham radio subjects, of people who sign in with a question or a comment, that's followed by, let me drop. That's followed by John, KC2WGB, who collects the mailbag information. In other words, people who don't yet have the right equipment to sign into the TechNet and talk to us live. They send him various kinds of communication, and he chooses a number of those that have general interest. And some of those are very challenging. That will be followed by Paul, WS2N, who is our space expert, and tells us what NASA's doing. And New Horizons has been doing some good things. And let me think, the Voyager is always doing good things. So there's a lot going on in space. Along the way, Hal gives us the benefit of his many years of experience with lots of radio equipment. He and I occasionally have a difference of opinion. You'll hear both sides of the story. You can decide that which one or both that fits your particular situation. As I was starting to say, let me drop. A person who does have a question. telling us their call letters, their name, and the word yes, which means they do have a question or a comment. Typical sign-in would sound like this, AC2GS, Roy, and yes. So, if you do have a question or a comment, give me your call letters and name right now. K2RA, I'll be listening.
Whiskey Bravo 2 Alpha Hotel, call on, check, yes.
W2OY,
Joe, yes.
Okay, so far we've got Chuck, WB2 Alpha Hotel Kilowatt. That's Joe, W2RYY. Is there anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now.
Dick, I think you had Richard in the background, too, at 2EO.
Okay, we've got Rich. We've got Rich and 2EO. Anyone else to sign in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
NWS2N is out here with a space report. And one comment or question.
Okay, I'm going to put you on the list as a person with a question. Paul? And let's see. And John? Not sure whether you haven't asked us a question in a long time, John. Don't you have a question you'd like to ask? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
I might have one tonight. I'll see what happens. We'll see how it goes.
Kind of thought so. It's been a while. Okay, Chuck is first. WB2 Alpha Hotel Kilowatt. You got it, Chuck? We'll discuss anything except antennas. And that's a joke. You got it, Chuck.
Okay, very good. WB2 AHK, American Hampton. I got a question to the host or the listening audience in regards to finding obsolete or unobtainium replacement parts. My question is there a database out there where someone who needs a particular part number for which a data sheet on it exists, have that database combed through other published data sheets and compute out in order of similarity possible other part numbers, which just might be close enough to work in the original's place. I'm not looking for other side approaches to finding a workabout replacement part. I'm talking about computerized databases. Perhaps a parts vendor somewhere has such a database. Because of my particular unobtainium situation, a person like me might be quite willing to be a paying customer to that provider of that database. So once again, does anyone know if such a database exists anywhere? Does anyone know of one? This question is in regards to particularly to N-channel RF amplifier FETs. The best minds around the world have for the last 15 years not been able to find a replacement for the Hitachi 2SK408s and 409s. The only ones out there are counterfeits. They just don't exist anymore except for poles. So that's my question. Is there a database where I can put in just the 2SK408 and somewhere and have a database print out possible close replacements for it? How about?
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah. Don't worry, Chuck. We only lost the last second of what you said because of the timeout. And Eric is going to tell us whether or not such a database exists and where to get that 2SK408 and 2SK409. I do believe that Radio Shack, in the good days, did have an equivalency list. You gave them a part number. Well, this was a lot of years ago. And they looked it up and said, Radio Shack part so-and-so is a substitute for that. I'll bet you that doesn't exist anymore. So where do we go these days, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW, the Tech Man.
K2RIW, K2J. Well, Chet has a unique problem. The 408 and 409 are actually the same silicon die, but they're in TO220 packages, and it's set up complementary, so that way, when you're doing something that's push-pull, Your 408 goes on one side, the 409 goes on the other side. The thing that's unusual about these transistors is that the maximum rating is 180 volts, runs about 2 amps, and they produce about 10 watts of power each. There in itself lies the problem. Now, this is designed to run actually all the way up to VHF. The package itself is problematic when you think about it. There are a number of lists that you can actually subscribe to. We've got a lot of old stuff. As we're finally getting rid of it, we don't deal with it anymore. But those particular transistors are unique in terms of their property, and that what makes it difficult. So even today, transistors are pretty much designed to operate on 50 volts. I have a solution for them, but it's a pain. But really, it would be easier to redesign the board with a single device to take the place of all transistors on there.
As you just said, Eric, you and your organization, your broadcast organization, subscribes to some lists because of the equipment that you're maintaining. That suggests to me that you paid some money for those lists. And I guess if a small number of these requests and a reasonable number of times existed, you're the right guy to get a hold of, if that's legal, if you're allowed to tell somebody else what's on that list. There isn't some kind of a non-disclosure agreement you had to sign in order to buy the list. But in the case of the 208-209 that you mentioned, and if it's really used in a push-pull manner, there's two different ways that the push-pull could happen. In one case, it's a PNP and an NPN stacked together, if you know what I mean.
No, not really push-pull. Think of it complemented. They're both the same. They're both N-channel.
They're both N-channel. As such, why are the two different model numbers if they're both N-channels in a similar package? And maybe that's the difference. Tell us a little bit about those two transistors, Eric. Go ahead.
GVZ was hot.
They're both the same transistor. One's wired, I don't remember exactly. I think one's wired EBC and the other one is wired DC. It's when you lay them down, one facing left and one facing right to get the right read. Go ahead, Hal.
They're FETs. They're not transistors. And they made them to sit on the board so you get a heat sinking on them. There are 48 used in this amplifier. And I already talked to Chet. We came up with a method of getting around it because the devices are not available. They are FETs, though. Two SCs are FET devices. But if Jeff could find, Chet could find some, it'd save a lot of headaches, but there's some modules out there that could just fit in, use the same interfacing that's in the JRL 2000 amplifiers, and go down the road. Go ahead.
Oh, one more thing. I got it from Good Word that there's a source, but there have been a lot of counterfeits that have been put together right. But there's a source in Ireland that supposedly has genuine parts. It's got a huge overstock. That's why they have it. That's the word that I got. But there are other places, including China, that will sell them to you, but chances are they're counterfeit.
There's none existing over the world, because I had the same problem finding them for our projects we're doing. They are gone. There are more counterfeits out there than anything else.
Eric, if Ireland did have an overstock of those, how does one find that Ireland source? Let's hope that it hasn't run dry. And is that the $48 per copy? And if I'm willing to rewire the board with jumpers, couldn't I use a pair of 408s or a pair of 409s? KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Well, if you can find 408s or 409s, you won't find either of them. What I got was from a distributor who was a very reliable source. I sent a link to Chet, whether he believes it or not, that's entirely up to him. If it were me, I would probably just get a pair and see if they're real.
Now, if you're smart enough to understand the data sheet, and you know the, I know this is a FET, but if it was a transistor, and you know the emitter base drop, so to speak, before it starts conducting, and you could readjust the,
I'm sorry, I said ABC before, I meant drain and fluid.
OK. about the device. Whenever you're using a pair of transistors in push-pull-like service or totem pole-like service, there's usually a fancy bias network, and if you're willing to readjust one of the bias resistors...
The bias in that particular circuit is really simple and quite ingenious, actually.
Okay. Do you believe anybody makes a transistor with 180-volt capability and 2-amp capability? I said transistor, but FET. Which might work like the 208 and 209.
Well, I'll tell you, I did actually go to International Electric Bias. My concept is you can get headsets that will actually go up to 30 megahertz. And you're going to find some really high voltage transistors, but then comes the problem with the AC port.
Okay. If a headset has the right voltage and current capability, what makes it difficult to substitute the headset for the 408 or 409? Over to you, Eric.
Well, they really designed it fast switches, so the try to operate analog in the way the depletion area that transistor is set up happens is very small. I suppose I could probably work it out and make it work, but, you know, I'm trying to find a replacement for someone that isn't going to fuss around too much.
Are they being used in these amplifiers as a totem pole circuit? In other words, the highest voltage is on the upper transistor, the ground, so to speak, or the negative voltage is on the lower transistor, and the junction between the two, with maybe capacitive coupling, goes out to the loudspeaker. As such, that is almost being used as the FET equivalent of an emitter follower. And therefore, the exact amount of gain is not too relevant, the exact frequency response is not too relevant, as long as the stray reactances of your circuit don't allow this 100 megacycle device, so to speak, break into oscillation at 50 megs. You may have to put in a certain number of 10 ohm resistors and 1,000 picofarad capacitors.
That's doable, or just that somebody else, because I'm not going to do it, somebody else needs to do that. I'm not quite sure that they can figure it out.
Okay, it's nice to know that it's possible. Yes, it may not be simple. So, 408s and 409s apparently have become almost non-existent. But once again, do you believe that Ireland source has any, or do you think they've all been used up? Over to you, Eric.
No, according to their website, they got a whole lot of them. But the question is now, are they real?
Okay, people apparently have developed some skepticalness as to whether or not a counterfeit device is being manufactured in China. I'd like to believe that Ireland is not just repackaging the Chinese devices, that they've either got their own source or they bought them way back in the days when they were available from the original vendor. Is this a vanishing vendor problem, Eric, where whoever originally manufactured them no longer in business?
It's
not a chance. They're made by Hitachi. There actually is a Chinese company that will manufacture FETs to your specifications. If you want to go that route, they're going to be cheap. Go ahead, Manny.
My question out of curiosity is, how do you tell the difference between the counterfeits and the real ones? Is that an easy test that can be done very quickly on a test bench?
You got it, Eric.
Actually, from what I read, the counterfeits have a protection diode that's actually wired backwards. That's quite bad.
So they're actually defective counterfeits.
That makes them almost non-operative, Eric?
Yeah, that'll make them non-operative real quick.
Why in the world would a counterfeiter do that? He's eventually going to get a whole lot of unhappy customers, and he's going to spread the word on the internet. And you would think that that counterfeiter...
That has actually happened to him.
Okay. What's stopping that counterfeiter from correcting his error if he's getting that much feedback and that much flack?
No, I suspect it's somewhat psychological. Because once you spread the word that there's bad parts out there, nobody's going to take a chance on him.
Yes.
An interesting question might be to buy one from the if the Irish distributor is reputable, purchase a pair of them, bring them into the shop, test them. If they're defective, send them back.
adjusted that already.
Yeah, what's the price of them from Ireland, Eric?
You gotta understand that these things are 10 watts apiece, and they're going into an amplifier that generates a kilowatt. So there's a whole lot of them there. I don't remember whether it's 24 or 48 is. It's a big number. But anyway, as far as I know, or at least the information that I was given, that was suggested to me, is that these people are very reputable, and they're a big distributor throughout Europe.
Okay. If they're $2 a piece, and I invest on a small number of them, and I get stung,
like 12 or 14 bucks, I forget. It's not that cheap.
Okay. And these amplifiers, if they're good for 10 watts dissipation each, I think that's what you said, and it's a kilowatt amplifier, it would sound like you're using a whole lot of them because it's an analog amplifier, not a switching type or a Class D amplifier. Is that true, Eric?
That's correct. Although, I've only seen the schematic for it, not the actual physical layout, but it seems like there's four of these boards with, I don't remember how many transistors are on each one, and they are then put to a combiner and get your final output, and that goes to the filter, the stuff that comes after.
If somebody has to buy these 408s and 409s as a replacement, it suggests that they were damaged. I presume if you put a short circuit on the output of an amplifier by mistake, you can damage transistors. Is that approximately the failure mode that you know about, Eric?
Actually, Chet or Hal is more qualified to answer that, because I haven't owned one. I'm just looking at this from a paper point of view.
Okay, Hal, what do you believe is the failure mode? Is it a pilot error, or the devices just sometimes are being used beyond their requirements? Over to you, Hal. Chuck, since you're the guy who owns the amplifier, do you have a guess as to what's the cause of failure? WB2, AHK, the guy who asked the original question. It's a goodie. K2RIW, go ahead, Chuck.
Hi, guys. WB2HK. Let me let it drop. All right. Well, I've had three or four of them over the years. It's a beautiful amplifier. It's 1,000 watts. It's rated for key down. They rate them key down 1,000 watts DC output, CW output for 10 minutes. And they definitely put out over 1,000 watts. I think my failure mode, it was pilot error, because I was using them in AM service. I got sloppy, and I think that's what happened to the last one. And so I have one that's left that needs to be repaired, and Hal has three of them. So rather than put the modules in that are now available on the internet, I've seen them. I was talking to somebody recently in the last day or so, and doing massive rewiring anyway, control wiring. I was hoping that somebody had an idea how to replace these little ones. There are 48 of them, and I think they're rated for 14 watts output. They're very small packages. So I would say, in my case, it was operator error. I shouldn't have used it on AM service on 160 meters. Over.
Oh-ho. So this is an RF amplifier. Up till now, I thought we were talking about a totem pole or push-pull audio amplifier. So this is a kilowatt transmitter. What frequency range is the transmitter supposed to be used over, Chuck? Go ahead.
So 16310, it has an automatic, it has a 1,000 watt automatic antenna tuner built inside of it. It's really a nice package. And they probably made 5,000 of them over the years. And they also have, Japan Radio also has transceivers. JST-245s and 145s that use the same transistors. I have a 245, and I think they use 8 or 9 of them in there. They use it for drivers, too. Same transistors. So, Eric, if you could just email me the aisle in place, if you don't mind, and I'll order some just for the hell of it. And I'm in concert with Hal. We're working together to see if we can do a workaround. It was just my last gasp hope here that I could try to find some. And then the only way to get them going is to replace the whole output assembly with modern day technology, K2RIWWB2HK.
Yeah, part of what's going on here is that if this was a tube amplifier, kilowatt type tube amplifiers in general are extremely forgiving. You could run it into a short circuit, an open circuit, for a limited amount of time, and the amplifier will laugh at you and just keep right on running. Many solid state amplifiers, you run them into an open circuit or a short circuit by mistake, and if there isn't the right kind of a protection circuit built in, damage can occur. The good news about solid state is, in general, they're more compact, and they're instant on. You don't have to wait for filaments to warm up. That's the good news. But many of these solid-state amplifiers are very persnickety about pilot error. And I worked on a number of military jobs where somebody thought they were going to take a high-power traveling wave tube, which is putting out a zillion watts of power, and they're going to make a substitute with transistors instead. And this was an amplifier operating in the KU band frequency region, around 15 gigahertz. Wow. 20 years ago, you look for kilowatt class transistors at 15 gigahertz. They were considerably more rare than hen's teeth, if you know what I mean. And the traveling wave tubes that can do it have been around a long time. So that particular substitution attempt was a right idea at the wrong time. I mean, wait 20 years, and yes, the parts that you want to do that with would be available. At that time, they were not. So, any further words on this, Eric? KE2EJ sounds like a beautiful amplifier, and I wonder how popular they are, and roughly the hold-on amplifier. Any idea what it costs, KE2EJ, K2RIW?
K2RIW, KE2J. Well, it is old, so there is protection circuitry in it, but I didn't see any thermal protection, so it's nice design. I do think that you could actually replace, I could probably design a nice single transistor amplifier that would fit on the existing heat sink, although I don't know because I haven't seen it. The way it's organized is perfect in terms of input and output, so. No, today you can buy, pre-scale, a 1 kilowatt transistor that goes all the way up to UHF. You know, pick your frequency, put the right reactions in front and behind it. The thing's got its own built-in protection circuitry. They even do a demo with it, doing a kilowatt, it's 2 meters. The guy shuts the bloody thing out, and you watch the board burn up, and the device survives, and is very happy. K2RIWK2J. Oh, Chad, also, I'm going to send your manual back tomorrow. But if you look at the last email I sent you, it's got the link to that place in it. K2RIWK2J.
That three-scale transistor that's bulletproof, kilowatt rated, roughly how many bucks? Are we talking about $400 worth here, Eric? Go ahead.
When they first released it, it was about $220. Now it's down to like $160.
A little bit pricey, but if they give you a recommended use circuit with circuit values in there, maybe it's got some fancy trifle or wound ferrite cores or whatever. The manufacturer's recommended circuit, by your standards, Eric, is it something that a crafty guy could build, or is it a little bit beyond the average home brewer? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
No, you can do one of two things. You can buy the demo board, or you can actually, they give you the traces on the inverted file of what the demo board looks like. You can make your own PC board. Depends upon what frequency you want. It's quite easy. Never built anything out of a Mitsubishi block like a 5770.
you know, how very straightforward, simple it is to get in and out of the chip. The only thing they don't give you is appropriate filtering afterwards to make sure your harmonics are stable on.
Does the demo board require exotic parts once you've got the free-scale amplifying transistor-like device with its built-in protection and a short circuit and open circuit protected? And now you're plugging that and other parts into the board. Is there anything exotic in there, like a fancy wound output transformer, Eric? Or is it really direct drive to the 50-ohm output connector of you, Eric?
Golly, output goes right into a 50-ohm load. I think it takes two capacitors and then some bypasses across the ALC line, you know, the line that lets the control wheel in. And that's it. And by the way, power tension.
Yeah, it sounds like this thing is running on something like a 48-volt supply, I'm guessing.
48 volts.
What was that again, Eric?
50 volts.
Okay, you keep keying the mic and talking simultaneously, and we keep missing everything except the word volt.
Sorry, 50 volts.
Okay, 50 volts. Now, there's a whole lot of surplus market 48-volt many ampere power supplies that used to be used on telephone circuits with a positive ground. Therefore, finding a power supply for this thing on the surplus market sounds like it could be easy. Is that true, Eric? Go ahead.
No, mostly we use a power transformer, a bridge rectifier, and a bunch of capacitors, and possibly a choke. It doesn't have to be regulated, you know.
Now, I needed a whole lot of amperes of 48 volts a few years ago. At that time, there were quite a number of websites giving you surplus power supplies, not very many dollars. They didn't have a transformer in there. It was a switching type power supply, lots of amps output at 48 volts. If this thing runs 50, and you've got a switching power supply that can deliver 48, you're essentially home free, and even making a minor modification to the regulator circuit in there would boost it up to 50 volts if you wanted it. Are those things still available? I can't believe they've all dried up by now. Over to you, Eric, KQLAW.
No, I will say new 50 volt, what are they, ATM supplies, not that expensive, new. Unfortunately, they've been made stronger these days. They don't make it bad. But as far as surplus goes, I couldn't answer that. I'd actually have to go looking. But I suspect that there's still a lot of that stuff around because, you know, there's still a lot of old phone companies that are, you know, just now getting rid of their crossbar.
So if it comes to an elaborate repair procedure to repair these amplifiers, as opposed to starting off fresh with one of these free scales, you're at a crossroads as to which is the path of least resistance to get the desired result. So, as you solve this problem, Chuck, please come back and let us know, because guaranteed there's a number of guys out there that would love to have kilowatt solid-state rigs somewhere in the 80 to 10-meter frequency region. WB2AHK, after some delay for the beep, K2IW and TechNet. You've got it, Chuck.
Well, I was just hoping, somebody had to let. This is my last gasp at it. I've been trying for 15 years to get parts. I thought I'd throw it out one more time. Tyler's quite astute in fixing these things. I have taken all the transistors out twice on two of them and put new ones in when I had them. Or I think at one time I had 2 amps and I had, between the two of them, I had enough transistors, FETs, to make one. And I parted out the rest on eBay. That's how I fixed the last one. And, yes, you could use one transistor, one FET, 408 or 409, just cross one of the legs there. That's been done before. So, Eric, if you're listening, when you send my book back, if you don't mind, if you just write the email address of the place in Ireland. I don't know if I have your email anymore. I'd appreciate that. I will buy some just for the heck of it. How I bet them. I bought 400 counterfeits. So I don't know how many hours, but he has got stuck also. But everybody else, if you go on the internet, there's so many people around the world that also got stuck. Well, anyway, great amplifiers. So thanks a lot for your help. Appreciate it. And back to Net Control, WB2AHK.
I've got one last question, Chuck, and that is, when one of these sets failed, does it go into the short circuit mode, which then causes failures of the others? Does this failure become a chain reaction, if you happen to know? Over to you, Chuck.
Well, what happens is the AMCOs are flying, and the power supply gets disconnected. I think it goes like sets of 12. There's four boards in there, four different amplification boards, two on each board. There's two boards, but there's two circuits on each board, and they're in groups of 12. So usually, from my past work on these things, when one goes bad, it takes out 6 or 12, and the amp shuts down with the protection circuit. So you're normally left with about 36 left over good ones. So you're 12 shy. I think Hal has in the past been able to get it going with 24 instead of 48, and that might be another solution. Run it at half power.
Yeah, that would be tempting. And even if you ran at full power, but very briefly, single sideband, where the peak envelope power is a kilowatt, but you're only doing that rather briefly if you're not running a flat-out speech clipping circuit, at much lower duty factor, half the number of transistors might survive, particularly if there's a thermal overload circuit in there that knows when the transistors are getting hot and starts giving you some kind of warning or some kind of cutback. Fun type amplifier. Let us know what you find out in the future. Joe, WB2RYY, what are you going to challenge us with tonight? WB2RYY, K2RYW, and TechNet.
I'm going to challenge you with an antenna question.
Fire when ready.
Okay. You had said that half a dipole antenna or a quarter wave antenna has a theoretical impedance at resonance of 36 ohms. The dipole is like 72 ohms. Okay, so I remember asking about this a couple weeks ago with the case of an antenna on a car, because a ground plane antenna, if it had the radial flat out, would be like half a dipole and have a lower impedance. And to raise the impedance, you flip the radial down at, so many degrees, 45 degrees, 40 degrees, something like that, to increase the impedance. Now, with a mobile antenna on a vehicle, like your quarter wave antenna, you can't bend the roof down. So you said you lengthen the antenna, or you would have to lengthen the antenna to raise the impedance. Is that correct?
Absolutely. If you go to either mic number one or mic number two's website, mic number one is amateurradio.tangovictor. Mic number two is limogtechnet.com. In either of those, you're going to find an article by K2RIW entitled How to Get Perfect Impedance Match of a Dipole. And it really is giving you a almost step-by-step use of the so-called Brown and Woodward curves. Both articles include the Brown and Woodward curves, but if you want to see it in full size in a book, any of the issues of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, the last three issues, it's in Chapter 4, of these Brown and Woodward curves. Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward, way back in 1945, did some very careful measurements with slotted line frequency meter rulers, so to speak. In other words, by making monopole antennas on a very large flat sheet of metal as a ground plane, they literally took every possible length and every possible diameter you're likely to use for a monopole and really measured the impedance, the resistive component, and the reactive component. Let me drop it. So these two graphs,
out of the Brown and Woodward curves, I call them, Brown and Woodward graphs. One graph is, what is the resistive value for all possible diameters and all possible lengths? And the other graph is, what is the reactance value? What you get when you study those graphs is that you'll find out that by doing nothing but changing the length, whether completely flat, I'm not talking about a cone-shaped ground plane radial system, completely flat radial system, and your automobile is, to the first order, it's like that, you can make the resistive component as low as 1 ohm and as high as 1,500 ohms by doing nothing but changing the length of the manifold. You've got a completely continuous, adjustable resistance value by changing the length. It's amazing how well kept that secret is. Once you select the right length to give you the right resistive component that you want, 99% of the time, the other graph of Brown and Woodward is going to tell you what reactance component you're going to get. And except for the case where it's exactly a quarter wavelength long, where it's resonant, you're always going to get some reactance. But don't let that don't let that intimidate you. Let me drop it. Once the resistive component of the impedance of your antenna is the one that you want, which is maybe 50 ohms or 70 ohms, you're halfway home. The fact that there's a reactive component left over means that there's a zillion ways you can cancel that reactance. If it's inductive reactance, you put in a capacitor. If it's capacitor reactance, you put in an inductor. You've got the choice of putting that reactance in series or in parallel. Mechanically, it's easier to put it in parallel. To put it in parallel, you can literally hang a capacitor or hang an inductor right across the feed point at the base of the monopole. Or, if it's a commercially made antenna and you don't want to disturb it, you can put a T-connector there, and one side off to the T-connector, you can hang your stub of inductor of a coaxial cable, short circuit or open circuit. By choosing the right length of a stub of a coax cable, you can synthesize transmitting grade. Inductor is a capacitor of any value you want. I'll admit that the technique is only going to be perfect at one frequency, but if at least if you decide that 3750 is your favorite frequency on 80 meters, and if you can get a near-perfect impedance match of high efficiency of the feed network on your mobile antenna at 3750, that's going to make a hell of a lot of people happy. And by way of putting in other plug-in devices, you can now make it work on 3900 as opposed to 3500, if you know what I mean. So lots and lots of people think that the only way you make the impedance perfect on a ground plane antenna is by slanting the ground plane radials. Absolutely not. That's just the most difficult way of doing it mechanically. Electronically is a much more sophisticated technique. Read that article and either one of those mic number one or mic number two sources, and you'll probably eventually say, after you do it the first time, a hell of a lot of people have come back to me saying, why in the world hasn't somebody told me this a long time ago? After my 35 or 40 years of experience doing a lot of military antenna work under difficult circumstances, it wasn't until I was in the consulting business 5 years downrange, 38 or so years of experience, before I suddenly discovered this secret. It was kept from me also. The V2RYY, K2RYW, the TechNet. Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
Now, I just wanted to point out that your stub, actually, variable length stub, duplex, gives us the ability to actually tune that stub within a certain range. Quite a nifty little device. And you could make an arrangement like that for your mobile antenna.
Yeah, if you're a very enthusiastic guy, and you've got a special temporary authority license, so to speak, from the FCC, where you're allowed to run moon mounts at 5 kilowatts, and guys have done that, you try to go out and buy a transmitting grade compact capacitor that can take 5 kilowatts and behave correctly with reliability. Whoa. Without some very special performance, without some very special made device and big bucks, you're going to have a lot of trouble. But to make a 5 kilowatt transmitting grade capacitor or inductor with a piece of stub coaxial cable, amazingly easy. So stubs can create a hell of a lot of magic in a very small package. The B2LYY, B2LXW, you got it, Joe.
Okay, for the purpose of this discussion, I'm just I'll be using an antenna, not the amateur band. The use of it really doesn't matter, but for just discussion purposes, the antenna has a frequency range of 150. Say, I'm going to give you some of those. It has a frequency range of 150 to 162. Okay, because it's easy to come up with the data this way. Versus the length, physical length of the antenna. I don't know what the resonant frequency is of the next range antenna exactly, but I'm just using this for discussion purposes. So 156 megahertz, the antenna is wavelength 1.92 meters, and I took a number of, because the antenna is rather thin itself as a quarter wave antenna, like about 16th of an inch diameter, somewhere around there. Steel whip. I took a number of 0.97 because of the changes the velocity factor because of the that particular thickness of a rod I'm using. I know then it would be maybe a little higher. I think it would be maybe a little lower, but I took 0.97 in there. That makes 1.86 meters divided by 4 is 0.466 meters or 18.36 inches. Now that's for a center frequency of say 156 megahertz. The actual length of the antenna of this commercially made antenna is actually 17.75 inches, which is 0.966% of the first number I gave you in inches. So that's what the discussion, the direction is going in. You said you had to make the antenna longer to make it 50 ohms. They're actually making the antenna shorter. So what's going on? They don't use anything like you're talking about on their antenna mounts. They simply put the antenna on the roof, under the end of the cable, that's all they do.
That antenna on the roof, is it really screwed down to the roof or is it mag mount, is question number one. And in the base of the antenna, is there any other kind of impedance matching device? An amazing number of 2-meter mag mount antennas have really got a loading coil built into the base. Over to you for those two questions, Joe, go ahead.
The antenna I'm talking about is a simple steel rod assembly. It has a small ball at the top, very small ball, like about not quite a quarter inch diameter ball. I guess that's the static dissipation. And the bottom end of the antenna has a rubber, looks like a cone-shaped type of piece of rubber. And the bottom, the very, very bottom of the antenna is simply round like a little thing. Curly cube type of thing, horizontally, round and round horizontally, to keep it contained within the rubber. And that has a chrome ring that goes around it, something goes on the antenna mount. There's no impedance matching device in the antenna, there's no capacitor in the antenna, and there's nothing on the cable that goes across it and series it or anything else. The cable's a simple piece of cable running RG58, so for discussion purposes, like I'm saying, my calculations show that the antenna should be longer, even for a theoretical quarter wave antenna, and the actual length is actually shorter. So, like I'm asking here, what's going on?
The one thing I don't know right now is that what does it use as a ground plane radials or ground plane, I think you're saying it goes directly to the sheet metal of the automobile. What does the manufacturer of that antenna claim its VISWA at the center frequency, which I think you said is 156 megs? What do they claim, Mr. Vizwa, Joe, go ahead.
Nominally, something like 1.2 to 1 at center frequency. So that's like a nominal. I don't remember if I've seen graphs. Well, actually, I think I have seen graphs. I think the center frequency is about 1.2 to 1, approximately.
And the base of that thing, is it similar to an NMO? Does the base really get screwed into the metal, sheet metal of the top of the car? Over to you, Joe.
Yes, exactly. This antenna is made to go on what's called an NMO mount, which I'm sure you're very familiar with.
There is a little bit of a mystery here as to It's a few percent short, which should be lowering the impedance from 35 ohms and 37 ohms, as opposed to raising it to the 50 that we want. That is a bit of a mystery as to how this compact thing, a little bit shorter, is giving the right impedance match totally at 156 megs. Huh, that's a good one. I presume you've owned a few of these, you've actually measured them, and the manufacturer is telling the truth. From all you can tell, Joe, go ahead.
CCC with a comment.
In just a moment. Yes, I have owned these antennas. I've worked in that type of industry. These antennas are typically used on low VHF frequency mobiles, taxi cabs, things, you know, of the like. And the frequency range antenna, like I said, from 150 to 162, the antenna is 17.75 inches. Now, for the next range down, which is what I've directly used, but I don't know what the center resonant frequency actually is. I don't remember what it is. It's like either 140 or 144 to 150. That antenna is 19 and an eighth inches, but I haven't done the calculations on that. I just usually don't know because I haven't remembered the numbers in my head as far as what it's cut for. So, back to you.
Lots of guys have built 2-meter ground plane antennas for the 146 megacycle region, and they made it 19 inches long. This thing is running at a higher frequency, and it's 17 inches long. It's in the right direction. You know, the numbers don't quite operate right. Let's see what Hal said about these things. K6DBZ, K2RIW, go ahead, Hal.
K2RIW, K6DBZ. It may be an antenna that may have a little matching section in the base. This way it would be physically shorter, but it'd be tapped at the 50 ohm point, and you know, 50 ohm match. I've seen that happen. Go ahead.
Joe has said he took it apart. He knows it's nothing but a simple rubber mount at the base. It's an NMO-like device. Let's get a confirmation on that one, Joe. To M2RYY, K2RIW.
Yeah, the antenna has an assembly, a chrome ring assembly, has a hole in it, about 3/8 of an inch diameter hole in the chrome ring. I'm not sure you've seen these before. They're regular Motorola antennas. The antenna rod itself is a piece of steel rod. It goes through a cone-shaped rubber at the bottom. That's just for, you know, weatherproofing and to keep it physically in place. The chrome ring screws onto the animal mount that goes through the roof of your vehicle. Normally, you can get these magma varieties, but they make the package normally to go through the roof of a car. Okay. There is no loading coil at all in the steel rod in any part of the steel rod antenna. No variations of it. Nothing. The only thing I said is that there's a small curlicue on the bottom of the antenna, only to the at the bottom of the rubber, just to simply keep in place. You can't pull the rubber off the end of the antenna. Back to you.
Impedance matching device, the curly Q.
Joe, you did say that there is or is not a curly Q. Also, that quarter inch diameter ball at the top is a top hat capacitor, even though it's a kind of small one to your eye. That is a top hat capacitor at those VHF frequencies. Back to you for conversion on this, Joe. Then we'll go over to Eric. RYY, K2RIW.
I've mentioned the antennas both ways. It doesn't change very much if the ball is missing, because in checking mobile installation, if the ball is missing, then typically you can whack the ball off by going to the car wash too many times. It can become, you know, dislodged and pulled off. That doesn't really seem to affect the tuning of it. I understood the ball on the top is a static dissipation. Maybe I'm wrong. The curlicue on the bottom is not a spring. I'm not talking about a spring. I'm talking about spread out horizontally, just to simply keep the antenna contained within the rubber. It's not acting like a coil.
Okay, it's not acting like a coil, and you call it a curly Q. Give us an X-ray view. What is the so-called curly Q at the bottom? What's it made out of? How big? Is it a spiral-like device, horizontally, vertically? Right now, we've only got words. Try to give us a mental picture on that thing, Joe. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I'll let you draw the mental picture, okay? Okay, by thinking of it like this. If you had a cone-shaped piece of rubber with a small hole drilled in the center of the rubber that resembled a cone, and you stuck an antenna rod in the center of that rubber, how would you keep the antenna from being pulled out of the rubber cone?
Here's DPC with one more comment. I guess you would get it not pulled out because it's going into some kind of a connector, and the cone-shaped piece of rubber, one way I could stop the whip from being pulled out is to make the base of the rib, of the whip antenna larger in diameter so that it could be inserted from the bottom but couldn't be pulled out from the top. I could do it with by mechanical means. Is that what was done, Joe? Go ahead.
Well, I imagine how they manufacture these things. They probably put the ball on the antenna last and put it to the rubber that way, but you're in the right direction. How would you not be able to pull a rubber off the bottom of the antenna? Think about that. How would you be able to do that? They don't make the antenna bigger at the bottom. It's the same diameter rod throughout the length of the entire antenna. The diameter of the antenna does not change. So what would you have to do to the bottom to make it not be able to be pulled out off this rubber bushing?
Casey, CBC, can I make one comment? We're going to take things in order. Joe first, Eric next, and your third, I'm sorry to say. I could take the bottom of the whip and literally make a small coil that where the coil makes a larger diameter that cannot be pulled through the rubber. Is that what they did, Joe? Go ahead.
Bingo! You got it. That's what they're doing.
Tell me why that curly Q, that curled piece of steel at the bottom, is not a series inductor making it electronically longer. Tell me why that's not happening, Joe, up to you.
Extremely small in size. That what I call a curly Q, or at the end of a, you know, like a pigtail, whatever you want to call it, looking that's perpendicular to the antenna, is extremely small in diameter. It's only about maybe 3/16 of an inch. And both sides of the coil are grounded to the top end of the antenna mount. They're both grounded. The antenna rod and the end of the curlicue, they're both touching the ground at the same time. So it can't be a coil if both ends are touching, it's completely grounded. In fact, the entire surface of this curlicue is equally touching the antenna mount on all sides. So it really can't be a coil.
You keep telling me it's being grounded. How in the world do you feed the RF energy to it if it's grounded? The words don't make sense, Joe, go ahead.
Excuse me, wrong choice of words. It's being connected to, equally connected to, the center contact on the antenna that goes into your car roof. Is that a better choice of words?
Okay, are you telling me the whip goes down the center of this coil, therefore the coil is short-circuited at both ends? Is that what you're telling me?
The end of this antenna simply looks like, if you pull a rubber up, which you can do, it looks like if they took the antenna rod and bent it in a circle, okay? Imagine that they just took the end of it and bent it into a very small circle, about 3/16 of an inch diameter circle. And then they turned that circle completely 90 degrees to the antenna. That's what it sort of resembles. Can you imagine that?
Is the axis of that coil at the base and the axis of the whip, are they collinear? Are they the same axis?
Pretty much they make the antenna rod be in the center of this little curlicue type of arrangement. It goes out horizontally, makes a small circle, and then the end of it just doesn't touch the rod at the other end. It's a very extremely small opening, but the flatness of the circle arrangement at the bottom is equally touching the antenna mount on all sides, which is also circular and slightly larger in diameter than this curly Q type of looking end of the antenna. If I had one to show you, next time you see it in person, I'll show you what I'm talking about. You'll understand, but I'm trying to describe it now so you get like a mental picture of it.
The real key right here now is that inductor at the bottom electronically active, or is it by some means not an inductor? It's only there as a mechanical device and it's being shorted out. Is there a real series inductor at the base of that antenna? Over to you, Eric. Joe. No.